You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, from Baghdad to Cairo to back here in London, we'll be reviewing the day's top stories here in the studio with Daniela Pellad and George Brock. Then, in the spirit of the World Cup and in mourning of the absence of Scandinavia, I'll chat with the author of Danish Dynamite, the story of football's greatest cult team.
Spain were their nemesis for a decade, from about 1984 to 1994. They knocked them out of three international tournaments and the World Cup qualifiers for 94. As well. For some reason, Spain just didn't have any fear of Denmark whatsoever.
And all this week, we're exploring Monocle's quality of life issue on newsstands now. Today, David Michon will be asking if the technological solution to enhancing our cities is always the smartest one.
Why not employ design rather than cameras to make cities safer? There are many studies that show building good neighborhoods decreases crime. Residents of mixed income, small businesses with eyes on the street, and a good flow of people night and day.
And later in the show.
But if I said 1, 2, 3, I wouldn't get 1, 2, 3, but I could get.
We'll talk teaching dolphins to speak and other televisual happenings with The Telegraph's Alice Vincent. That's all coming up here on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, starting right now. Also, apologies in advance for any sudden outbursts or exclamations during the next 45 minutes. These will pertain to Australia versus Holland. Leading off the next hour, however, here is Paul Osborne with the world news.
Iraq has formally requested US airstrikes against Islamist militants in the country. Earlier, insurgents launched a major offensive on Iraq's biggest oil refinery. It's not clear who's now in control of the facility in Baji. Officials say they defeated ISIS fighters, but other reports claim the militants seized three-quarters of the refinery. The head of the US military, General Martin Dempsey, has told a Senate panel that events in Iraq are a huge cause for concern.
Al-Qaeda-inspired extremists raising flags over Iraq's embattled cities triggers in me the same thing that runs through the minds of any veteran who served there, which is bitter disappointment that Iraq's leaders failed to unite for the good of their people. I share alarm about the future of Iraq, and we are developing a full range of options to help stabilize the region.
Hundreds of people have been killed since the start of the militant offensive last week, but Raffaella Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute doesn't think Baghdad will fall.
What I think we'll see is instead a sort of increase in violence within the city, be this in terms of attacks launched by, suicide bombers sent by the group, or other sorts of large-scale incidents, maybe along the line of what Shabab has been doing in Mogadishu, coordinated attacks on specific institutions. However, I think the idea that ISIS is going to sweep into Baghdad and take over the city is a bit of a stretch for the group now.
The World Health Organization says more than 300 people have died since the start of an Ebola outbreak in West Africa in February. In total, 337 deaths have been recorded across Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. The WHO says that authorities in all three countries are struggling to contain the outbreak. Ukraine's president says government forces will soon start a temporary, unilateral ceasefire in the east of the country. Petro Poroshenko says it's an opportunity for pro-Russian separatists to lay down their weapons. But one group has already rejected the proposal, which followed a phone call between Mr. Poroshenko and the Russian President Vladimir Putin. It's now thought at least 21 people died in a bomb explosion in the north of Nigeria. A suicide bomber detonated a device as people were watching a World Cup match on television in Damaturu in Yobe State. It's one of three under emergency laws after a long-running violent insurgency by Boko Haram. In Brazil, the Nigerian football team said their hearts go out to the victims.
Emmanuel, we are more than ever determined that the only way we can console and condole these people who lost their lives or who are injured is to just do one thing. Go ahead and beat Bosnia and qualify for the next round of the World Cup.
There's been a 20% rise in the number of attacks on foreigners in Germany. There were more than 470 last year. Ministers say they're worried extremists are exploiting a rise in applications for asylum. They've also warned that the threat from Islamist groups in Germany is growing. Israeli troops have arrested dozens more Palestinians as they continue their search for three missing teenagers. More than 200 people have now been arrested over the disappearance of the three students who vanished in the West Bank last week while hitchhiking home. More than 50 Palestinians freed in a prisoner swap 3 years ago are among the latest to be detained. Hamas has denied Israeli government claims that it was involved in the disappearances. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. It's 18:06. Australia have had a perfectly good goal disallowed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18:06, which will be 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, we have George Brock, head of journalism at City University here in London and author of the book Out of Print, Newspapers, Journalism and the Business of News in the Digital Age. And also here is the journalist Daniela Pelled, an editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and a regular Monocle contributor. We'll start in Iraq. Time-served wisdom regarding the Middle East holds that things will usually get worse before they get even worse. But even by those standards, Iraq's last week also has been remarkable. The latest that is that Iraq's military claims to have repelled an assault on the oil refinery at Baiji. Most other observers, including oil markets, appear to believe otherwise. And in the last few hours, Iraq is now formally requesting US airstrikes. George Brock, I'll ask you first, is this likely to be one of those things where America has requested that Iraq request that America send aircraft, or is Iraq just appealing for help off its own bat here, do you think?
No, I rather think it's what you see is what you get here. I think that the Americans are going to be really rather reluctant to do that kind of thing. Yes, I know they've said in recent days, well, we're considering this, we're considering that, we're talking to Iran and so on and so forth. But let's not forget, you know, America tried to leave some troops behind in Iraq. The negotiations about it broke down. They took everybody out, bar a few Marines guarding the embassy in Baghdad and so on. No, I don't think they're particularly keen to be ordered, requested, or kind of ordered as if off a military menu back. They've got a very difficult dilemma. They're going to experience a very big blowback in public opinion in the States if they try anything which isn't effective. And it's rather unlikely that they've got military options that are going to be effective.
Daniela, here in the UK, David Cameron has today been giving it the whole doing nothing is not an option thing. Is he right? Is doing nothing not an option?
Well, there's an argument to be made that doing nothing is a contributory factor to this. Like, let me explain.
This would be doing nothing in Syria.
Yes, quite. And I rather unfashionably, perhaps, have been a supporter of intervention in Syria from very early on. I think it's too late now. But it was a genuinely civil society, peaceful uprising. And by hanging back and by really dithering in an unforgivable way, I think the West has allowed things to get to the situation that it's in now. And again, I'm not even sure that ISIS intended to do more than sort of knock off a few post offices or anything. I think they're pretty surprised at their own success. They're enormously wealthy now. They're cutting an incredible swathe through Iraq. Everyone is shocked. I think they're shocked too. But they seem to be unstoppable. Now, what can the Americans do with airstrikes? I think limited success, but then the alternatives looking towards Iran are also pretty worrying.
This is one of those situations, isn't it, George Brock, where outside powers, whether it's Britain, America, the wider West, there isn't an obvious, clear, straightforward, sensible and good thing to do, is there?
No, there isn't. You can only judge whether anything, including intervention by force, will achieve anything if you try to look at the overall. There are really only two ways that things can go. You can either try to reconstitute these states, by which I mean Syria and Iraq, or you can say the settlement that began those, this is the settlement known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement after the First World War, essentially dismembering the French and British possessions or colonial possessions in the Middle East. You can say that that system, which created Syria and Iraq as countries, has fallen apart for good. Well, that brings you to a whole series of extremely difficult choices, like if they're going to be dismembered, what is the least bad way in which these states get dismembered? Once you start thinking in those terms, which it seems to me the fundamental questions, the points at which you could actually use military force don't look very much.
No, they do not. And in terms of if people, and this is something that is now being openly discussed, the possibility of Iraq ceasing to be Iraq. We have the Prime Minister of Kurdistan, Nekivan Barzani, saying he doesn't believe Iraq will stay together, which seems like a fairly obvious test balloon for a declaration of independence by Kurdistan. Daniela Pellet, is this going to come down to a decision about how the breakup of Iraq and possibly Syria gets? There's no unmessy way that gets done. But are we looking at trying to figure out the least messy way that gets done?
Well, for the Kurds, they have the advantage right now. I mean, so far, they're the winners thus far. Possession is 9/10 of the law. And what the whole dispute over oil that attempted legislation failed to get through the Iraqi parliament, this now has been sorted out. The Kurds are not going to abandon Kirkuk. They have it now. Why would they leave? And they're the only effective, seem to be the only effective state fighting body in the region as well that's motivated enough.
Well, to return to, I guess, the debate that is happening in London and in Washington, and we saw David Cameron, as I said, talking about doing nothing is not an option, sort of raising the spectre of ISIS stroke ISIL expanding their war to the West, etc., etc. How surprised are we to see, I guess it's been interesting watching, that it just seems to be the same people who were having this argument 10 years ago surfacing again, the sort of the do-nothing peaceniks on one side and the foaming-at-the-mouth neocon crazies on the other side. Why has nobody replaced them?
I think some of the debate around this has been rather nauseating, really. There's definitely been a tone of sort of, we told you so, really irrelevant of what is happening now. And triumphalism. No, I think quite a few people have gone away to sort of to relative obscurity. But look, you know, it's an opportunity that it's very hard to resist to revisit the foreign policy decisions of 10 years ago. I mean, Tony Blair's intervention in this debate has been rather sort of stunningly misfired, I think.
It has been weird, though, watching people on both sides just turning up going, this proves that I was right all along.
I think it's a combination, in the case of the American neocons in particular and Blair, a combination of kind of temperament and guilt. Particularly in the case of the American neocons, they do know, I am convinced, watching and listening to them in their heart of hearts, that they were central to one of the biggest foreign policy blunders America has ever made in its history. But by temperament and character, they are the best form of defense is attack. So they're out there saying, no, this is all a problem caused by Obama leaving Iraq. Well, you can criticize the way Obama negotiated his way out of Iraq as a kind of marginal question, but, you know, The big problem was triggering off latent instability. It's no good Tony Blair saying the Middle East is permanently unstable. It all would have happened anyway. He's ignoring the difference between latent instability, which exists in many states in the world, and actually active instability, where people are so unstable they go out and kill each other in large numbers, which was triggered off by the invasion.
But at the same time, I think it's misleading to be able to claim that they can draw a straight line from March 2003 to June 2014. Things are not that simple. And that's, I think, what I found rather offensive about some of the commentary on this, is that it's just been very, very self-serving. And we're back to that debate about imperialism and wars for oil. And it is like watching, not watching an episode of Friends, but it's watching, really going back to the early 2000s.
Do you think, though, I mean, it occurs to me that maybe that's not that either of the dogmatists on either side would admit this, that this is an implicit acknowledgement of our own impotence, that everybody is looking at this ghastly mess without the faintest clue what to do about it. So it's kind of easy to argue over what happened in 2003, because we know what happened in 2003.
I think you put your finger on an important point. I think commentators absolutely love to analyse things in terms of whether somebody in America or Europe made a mistake or got something right or whatever. They are very slow to say about situations like this, this is a civil war being fought by people inside the borders of that country for reasons that actually they have.
But civil wars are never quite civil wars.
Analytically, people get to that very slowly.
Because other actors are involved. You know, other actors are involved in all civil wars, and in Syria, definitely. And that's the problem we're going to see in Iraq very soon, if not already, is how outside actors respond and how they get involved.
Well, on that happy thought, we should move along to slightly more encouraging news from more or less the same region. Egypt yesterday freed on medical grounds, they're saying, Abdullah El-Shami, one of several Al Jazeera journalists who have been detained on an assortment of absurd charges for some time now. El-Shami had been held for 307 days, had been on hunger strike since January. Is this genuine compassion by Egypt, George Brock? Are they just mortified by the idea of him dying in prison and making an already embarrassing situation more so?
It would be very dangerous to go and say that we're on the verge of them letting all of those Al Jazeera journalists and their colleagues go, but they have let out one. There is one who seems to think, and has even dared say out loud, that he thinks he would be the next to go. He is also receiving medical treatment. It is just possible, but I am being very careful not to go stronger here, it is just possible that they are going to gradually let them go in order to reduce the embarrassment and the difficulty that is causing them. But it is, I underline, not certain.
Daniela, what do you think? Because to every outside observer, the charges these men are being held on are, they're risible. They're absolutely idiotic. And surely at some level, Egypt understands that. Does Egypt... What I've never been able to figure out, I guess, is Egypt actually going somewhere with this, or is this just one of those things where stupidity has acquired an irresistible momentum and everybody's where we are, even though no one really wants to be here?
Well, maybe there's an element of that, but it's also political. It's because of the beef they have with Qatar.
Yeah.
And the supposed, perceived, whatever support that Al Jazeera would or might have for the Muslim Brotherhood. This isn't really about freedom of speech. And although, as a journalist, as a human being, I'm very delighted that Al Jazeera journalists hopefully will be freed very soon, this doesn't really have any impact on civil liberties on the ground. I mean, the space for dissent in the media in Egypt has been shrinking steadily. And the consequences for Egyptian journalists imprisoned and intimidated, I don't think there will be any knock-on effects for that. I think it would be very sad as well with the efforts that people have made with hashtags and hashtags to fight for the release of these journalists. I think it would be very sad if we forgot that the fight for freedom of speech and freedom of press continues in Egypt, even after their hopefully imminent release.
Well, the verdict in the trial of Mohamed Fahmy, Baher Mohamed and Peter Gresti is due on June 23rd. They remain in custody in Cairo. I'll be back with Daniela Peled and George Brock after this.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said brand strategy company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from. you get obsessed about the details. And if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Football fever has come to Midori House.
Here in Monocle 24, we'll bring you the music, the icons, the politics and the protests. Everything but the results.
Listen to daily columns from our team of writers on The Briefing, profiles of great sporting icons on The Globalist, and a World Cup diary live from Brazil. Every day on the Monocle Daily.
As if that's not enough, we also have a dedicated website at monocle.com/World Cup.
The World Cup on M24. Everything but the results.
Bola pra frente!
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and George Brock, head of journalism at City University here in London. We'll look now at Israel, where the kidnapping of three teenage seminary students on the West Bank has turned into another of those Middle Eastern stories where people can't even agree on the basic facts of the case, never mind its implications. Daniela, first of all, as far as we understand it, what actually happened here?
Well, these three teenagers were hitching a lift back to their homes from their yeshiva in the West Bank. Now, hitching is very, very common in the West Bank. It's not so well served by buses. Nothing extraordinary about that. They weren't missing. One of them made a phone call to say that he was being kidnapped. Rather unforgivably, this wasn't taken seriously. So the kidnappers had a good 6 hours in which they could cover their tracks. And I don't know quite how sensitively I can put this, but it really doesn't look good for these three boys. Past experience of kidnappings in the West Bank have not ended well for the victims. There's been no message, there's been no claim of responsibility, there's been nothing. And unlike in Gaza, where the soldier Gilad Shalit was held for a very long time, and the Israelis couldn't find him, the West Bank, the intelligence and the surveillance and so on, you know, it's a very different system. And I think the kidnappers will have known this, and the fact they haven't made any demands, as I said, it really doesn't look good.
There have been accusations and counter accusations. Israel is blaming Hamas. Hamas is dismissing the accusations as, quote, silly. The IDF have detained 200 people. Are they just rounding up the usual suspects at this point?
Well, they are. I mean, they're leveraging the opportunity. I mean, part of it is to get general intelligence on this situation. And it does seem likely that it was perhaps a Hamas cell. I mean, this was a well-planned endeavour. This wasn't just some people that just rocked up and did it on the spur of the moment. But yeah, at the same time, they're also using the opportunity to try and drive a wedge between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, because, of course, they've just signed a reconciliation agreement. And as well, I have to say, Netanyahu and his government are making some serious political capital out of this rather tragic situation. I mean, they're blaming the Palestinian Authority for it, even though Abbas is really the only partner for peace they possibly have. And the kidnapping happened in an area where his forces have no security control. And they're fighting this incredibly intense social media campaign as well. I don't know where all this is going. It's going to a very, very bad place. That's what I fear.
George Brock, the point Daniela made there about how, like everything else that happens in the Middle East, this has become the focus of a huge media battle between various sides. You know, we were people on social media plastering it with dubiously sourced photographs claiming to be pictures of Palestinians celebrating this all over the world. They may or may not be, but it's always the case, weirdly, about the Middle East, where everything that happens, people with widely divergent opinions seem to be able to believe that the same event proves them right.
If you watch the way the media handle the Middle East, you find the media mirroring this way of doing things because the polarization is so wide, and it above all, what makes the Middle East different as an area is it is so long. The actual amount of, I mean, it has just gone on so long in time. Therefore, the amount of overlap, the amount of common understanding that people have, despite the fact that they may live yards from each other, separated sometimes by barbed wire and sometimes not even by that, the amount of common understanding is really very low. And I think that when you get a new kind of communication technology, like, say, social networking, it will simply reflect that very basic fact that the human beings grouped there in however many hundreds of thousands or millions just are divided into groups who simply do not see anything the same way.
Daniela, what do you think? Do you think the Middle East is, specifically Israel-Palestine, is a special case like that? Because I've noticed this myself. I've written things about the area, and I'm sure you've had the same experience, where you get people, all of whom have looked at exactly the same bunch of words on a page, and will write to you and accuse you of being both a, you know, crazed Zionist settler-building Likudnik and also a fellow traveller of Hamas.
I'm very glad to say that articles I've written for Monocle over the years have elicited exactly that reaction.
But what is it about that particular area that or that particular issue, if you will, that makes people unable to see any other point of view?
I think partly because so much attention has been paid to it, and there's so much vociferous lobbying, and so many people feel a connection to it, and so many people feel that this conflict is amazingly exceptional. You know, to misquote, who was it who said that all unhappy families are unhappy?
Tolstoy, I think.
That's the fella. All conflicts are similar.
One of those Russians.
One of those chaps. All conflicts are similar and all conflicts are different. And what's happening in Israel-Palestine is not exactly the same as apartheid that was in South Africa. And it's not exactly the same as a million other conflicts and ethnic sparrings. But at the same time, it's not something so magical and so special that it can't be solved and it can't be resolved. But it seems to be that the people involved and their allies have elevated it to this conflict that will never be solved. That it's not about territory anymore. It's about some magical situation. And it will only be solved when the two sides learn to love each other. And that's not how conflict is solved anywhere in the world.
And we probably shouldn't hold our breaths waiting for that eventuality in this particular instance. Finally, we should look at the admission by Britain's spooks that they snoop on the Facebook and Google mail traffic and the web searches of this country's citizens, and that they're legally entitled to do that without warrant because the firms are based abroad. George, is this as ingenuous as it sounds from our intelligence service?
Well, it's ingenious is a rather flattering term for
ingenuous
it.
I was going with there.
It's
a fine line frequently.
I'd say it was it was close to Jesuitical actually, but and you said it's within the law. What they're doing is they're claiming it's within the law. The statement to which you're referring by the guy who coordinates the government's counterterrorism and intelligence strategy is strictly speaking, a statement in a case in which the judge may, in the end, give an opinion about whether or not he thinks that this particular, it's not the centre of the case, but he's not prevented from giving an opinion on whether they are doing it. What they are doing is exploiting a law that wasn't passed until 2000, and therefore people were chewing it over and writing it in the years before then. Facebook, Twitter, so on, none of that existed at that stage. Digital communications in general have advanced a very long way in the last 15 years, inventing things which have never even been thought of at that stage. They are exploiting a distinction between internal communications. I email you inside this country. Let's suppose the email doesn't pass to a server outside the UK. Strictly speaking, there are limits on what they can snoop about what you and I are communicating. But the moment our messages go outside to a server anywhere outside the UK, that is, quote unquote, an external communication, and they can sweep it up along with everything else.
So the message to terrorists would appear to be then just use domestic servers and they'll be absolutely fine. Daniela, is this a case of, as George points out, technology has moved rapidly, whereas the law tends to move fairly slowly? Are we just in a situation where technology has outrun our ability to regulate it?
Well, completely. And it's not just the legislation. Conceptually, I don't think we quite understand what's going on, not just in terms of the 12-year-olds who post their rather embarrassing statuses on Facebook, or older people who should know better who moan about their boss in full public view of the world, but also the fact that the data is so enormous and it's so massive, and we're talking about such hard to understand quantities of information, and how it can be used, and who can control it, and who can look at it. I think that's really where we're at. Certainly legislation has got a very, very long way to catch up with that. I find it quite hard to understand myself.
But there is a genuine dilemma here. I mean, the old-fashioned thing was you wouldn't allow policemen or spooks to look at somebody's phone calls, for example, unless they had some specific interest in, reason to believe they needed to know what a specific individual was up to. If you look at the gigantic expansion of communication that digital has allowed, you aren't likely, I think, to end up in a position of saying that should still be the principle. They've clearly got to be able to look at communications on a slightly larger scale. However, what the Snowden NSA revelations showed to us was that if they collect everything on an indiscriminate and industrial scale, they are really sweeping up a very great deal. And, for example, it puts them in a position to spot, because this is a subject I happen to be interested in, even from really quite basic data, who journalists' sources are, for example. It's some information we don't particularly want the state looking at here and there. So the dilemma is, how do you allow them to do what they want to do, given modern communications, and make the law keep up with it, while balancing a certain amount of privacy and protection for the individual? And it is, we've only just begun to think about it. And do I have the precise legal answer for you, Andrew? No, I don't. Not yet.
On that happy thought, we will have to leave it there. Daniela Pellard and George Brock, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu sou London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be continuing to leaf through Monocle's new quality of life issue, and we'll remember Denmark's great football team of the 1980s. As far as Australia's great football team of the 2010s goes, it's currently Australia 2, Holland 3. Ahead of all that, Paul Osborne has the world news headlines.
Iraq has formally requested US airstrikes against Islamist militants in the country. Earlier, insurgents launched a major offensive on Iraq's biggest oil refinery, and it's still not clear who is fully in control of the facility in Baji. Officials said they defeated the ISIS fighters, but other reports say the militants managed to seize three-quarters of the site. The World Health Organization says more than 300 people have died since the start of an Ebola outbreak in West Africa in February. In total, 337 deaths have been recorded across Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia. And the WHO says authorities in all three countries are struggling to contain the outbreak. Ukraine's president says government forces will soon start a temporary unilateral ceasefire in the east of the country. Petro Poroshenko says it's a chance for pro-Russian separatists to lay down their weapons, but one group's already rejected the proposal. And new figures show there's been a 20% rise in the number of attacks on foreigners in Germany. There were more than 470 last year. Ministers say they're worried that extremists are exploiting a rise in the number of asylum applications. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. Welcome back to Midori House Live on Monocle 24. 21:33 near enough in Moscow, 18:33 in London, 14:33 in Rio. Time now to take a look at the freshest and latest issue of Monocle magazine, which is on a newsstand near you now. It's our annual Quality of Life edition, and all week on Midori House we've been hearing from our editors and correspondents on what makes a city great or less so. Today it's the turn of David Michon, who asks if the technological solution to enhancing our cities is necessarily the smart one.
There has been a lot of chatter and clatter in the world of urbanism about smart cities, using technology to improve the operation of everything from parking to health services. It's a rather nebulous term, but at its heart there's an important question. How much of a role can or should technology play in cities? Where some cities are happy to let independent app developers run with it in some sectors, handy transportation apps are now far from newsworthy. In others, centralized control is still very much en vogue. Exhibit A, security, with CCTV as its most public face. In 2010, IBM designed Rio de Janeiro's Operations Center, a citywide system that integrates 30 agencies and boasts a main control room so littered with jumbo screens, it would seem as if the city were in the business of launching spacecraft. In California, a similar center has been proposed for the crime-plagued city of Oakland. and the use of CCTV cameras is nearly unfettered in London, which has the highest per capita number of cameras of any city in the world. If cities are not opting for more cameras, they're certainly looking to integrate city-run systems with private ones. Remember that most of the useful footage of the Boston Marathon bombing came from cameras operated by Lord & Taylor Department Store. The objective is to create networks of coverage that can follow you throughout any public space, and some private ones too. Chicago and New York have already taken this step. But is a technological solution to security always the smart one? There are a number of reasons why residents are uncomfortable with cameras, whether it's their ominous appearance or the sense of constantly being watched. As with many other technologies, often the more you're aware of it, the less you like it. And some city planners agree. Why not employ design rather than cameras to make cities safer? There are many studies that show building good neighborhoods decreases crime. Residents of mixed income, small businesses with eyes on the street, and a good flow of people night and day. A beautiful, well-lit, well-connected place can become one where people care enough to look after it and, in essence, monitor themselves. It's an appealing idea where quality of life is of primary concern. There's no doubt that the next generation of thinking on CCTV will have to incorporate this. Where and when should cameras be avoided, and perhaps more importantly, where can the technology be used wisely? Could CCTV actually be an element in the nervous system of a healthy, human-centered urban environment? Learning about behavior through observation has an entire discipline of the human sciences dedicated to it, and there's no reason, if used cautiously and subtly, that cameras couldn't help to inform good urban design through helping us understand how people move through our streets. Humanistic intentions for CCTV can improve our built environment and not just serve as a deterrent to violence and crime. It just depends who's looking through the lens. For Monocle, I'm David Michon.
And that was David Michon on Smart Cities. Tune in tomorrow on Midori House to hear Steve Bloomfield explain what might be done to pop London's ever-inflating housing bubble. Coming up next, we'll look at the story of football's, or at least Denmark's, greatest cult team.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Puerto Rico is struggling with a faltering economy and an ongoing debate over its status as a U.S. territory. Monocle Films meets the Puerto Ricans attempting to rethink the island's future.
Since we are a country without a nation, without a structured state, I believe that we have wasted a lot of our time in fighting. We do not have consensus regarding our history, and that is also what makes it interesting.
A cinematic portrait of the newfound pride in Puerto Rico, now showing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. One built-in disappointment to the 2014 World Cup is the total no-show by the nations of Scandinavia, who can usually be relied upon to cheer a tournament up by surprising their way to the semi-finals, as Sweden did in 1994, or deflating a conceited Brazilian team, as Norway did in 1998. Few Scandinavian sides are as sorely missed, however, as the Denmark of 1986, who laid waste to their qualifying group in imperious style, including a 6-1 tubbing of Uruguay, before self-destructing in glorious fashion against Spain. That great Danish, I'll just pause for applause there, side of the 1980s is now memorialised in a new book, Danish Dynamite, by Rob Smythe, Lars Eriksson and Mike Gibbons. I spoke to Mike earlier today.
The reason Lars, Rob and I got into the team was we were about sort of 8-9 years old, around the same time, around the time of the 86 World Cup, and it was all of our first World Cups, so I think that kind of leaves a very big impression on you when you're a young person. I mean, Lars obviously is Danish, so they made a big impression on him. They were his national team. But for Rob and I think, because English football at the time, it wasn't in a very good place. You know, the England team wasn't very good. So to see this team from Denmark in this amazing kit play this amazing football kind of sort of really captured our imaginations, and it didn't matter that they didn't win anything to us. It was just,
can you remember the first time you saw them, what it was that made an impression?
I can, yeah. The first game I saw of them was they beat Uruguay 6-1, and Uruguay were the South American champions. And the game was on at 11 o'clock, I think, in England, and my dad had just got a video recorder specifically for the World Cup. So I asked him to take this game. I'd never even seen Denmark or Uruguay play. It was the first day we had the video recorder, so I said, you know, can you record this? And, you know, I'd like to watch the game the next day. And I saw it, and it just kind of blew me away. I'd never seen anything like it to that point. And I kept the tape for years and years and years, and, you know, watched it over and over and over. And it's an amazing performance. I mean, as I say, Uruguay were the South American champions, and, yeah, they absolutely thrashed them. It was incredible.
But that Danish team at the 86 World Cup, and maybe this was part of the appeal, because they did rather go up as a rocket than come down as a stick. As you mentioned, they trounce to Uruguay, they sail through their opening group, and then get absolutely hammered by Spain in the knockout round. What went wrong? Everything is the obvious answer, but specifically.
Everything went wrong. I mean, there was so much focus on the group of death, the group in the first round, that I think just to get through that in itself was an achievement. So they got to the end of that, and they were getting a lot of plaudits and everything by this point as well, and they'd never been to a World Cup before, so it was all, you know, new and exciting. And then for the knockout phases, you have to pick yourself up and go again. And they came up against Spain with their nemesis for a decade, from about 1984 to 1994. They knocked them out of three international tournaments and the World Cup qualifiers for 94 as well. For some reason, Spain just didn't have any fear of Denmark whatsoever. There were a couple of players that were carrying injuries by that point. A lot of the players are very old. There's a kind of feeling that the players overtrained for the first round. So they, in their group phase, they hit the ground running. Whereas the kind of theory is now that to win a World Cup, you have to kind of build up slowly and, you know, progress, you know, and get better as the competition goes on.
So in terms of putting the book Danish Dynamite together, how did you go about tracking down the players and the officials, and how keen were they to relive the glory days? Because footballers or sportsmen in middle age often have somewhat mixed feelings about revisiting the glory years, especially if the glory years didn't actually put any silverware in the cabinet.
I mean, they were all sort of universally very helpful. I mean, there are only two really of the main players, Frank Arnesen and Søren Lerby, that we couldn't get hold of. Everyone else, you know, was perfectly affable. The manager, Sepp Piontek, gave us 3 hours, which was just an absolute joy. And I think we were speaking to players as well from an era before, you know, they'd been media trained out of, you know, saying anything, you know, even remotely controversial or anything like that.
Because they presumably, a lot of them would actually have had day jobs in the 1980s.
They were. I mean, they were every man as well. I mean, sort of even Nielsen, the centre-back, he's gone back to being a plumber since he finished playing football. And he's got a European Cup winner's medal. So it's like kind of, it seems crazy that, you know, that he's now a plumber again. So we spoke to him in his yard on some upturned buckets. For an hour. That's how we conducted that interview. We met Klaus Berggren, one of the midfielders who now runs a women's clothing line. So we met him in his warehouse and interviewed him there twice.
Do that 80s team, and I guess the obvious answer to this would be that they won the European Championship in 1992, having just snuck into the tournament in somewhat bizarre circumstances. Mm. But that aside, do they have a legacy? Does anyone still play football like that, or is it simply not possible anymore?
I mean, occasionally you see teams like Argentina in 2006 were very... There's a kind of sense when a team plays collectively like that, that it just kind of raises the whole... However good the individuals are, it just kind of raises the level of the whole team. And you very rarely get that sense with a team, I think, which is one of the reasons why Denmark was so special. But, I mean, I don't think I've seen a team, internationally anyway, quite that, you know, breathtaking. And who play that attacking as well. I mean, football's, you know, got more defensive over the years, you could argue.
We are currently watching a World Cup which is not only lacking Denmark, but is lacking any Scandinavian teams at all. Is there a decline, do you think, in Scandinavian football, or is that just a fluke? I mean, Sweden and Iceland both ran it fairly close in qualifying.
Yeah, they did. I mean, obviously Sweden have got Ibrahimovic, but, you know, you need more than one player. I think that's the main thing. With Denmark, they've got a lot of very good young players. They've got a lot of young players based at Ajax. But it's going to take a while for those players to come through and, you know, become seasoned internationals.
Just finally, do you have any other favourite underrated World Cup teams? I've always had a soft spot for the 94 Bulgarians myself.
Yeah, I love the 94 Bulgarians. It's funny you should mention that. I mean, yeah, they were brilliant. I mean, they got hammered in their opening game, I think. I think they lost 3-0 to Nigeria. And then, you know, later in the tournament, they knocked Germany out. And anything where it's unexpected like that. I think one of the things about the World Cup now is you get so few surprises these days, because in the kind of the age of the global village that we live in, you know everything about every team and every player before you even get to the World Cup. So it's kind of lost its capacity to surprise you in that way, I think, which is a real shame.
That was Mike Gibbons, co-author of Danish Dynamite, the story of football's greatest cult team, speaking to me a little bit earlier. Time now for a bit of music. We were just discussing Scandinavian football, and we will shortly be discussing television. And so, and this is really pretty brilliant programming. This is A-ha, who were from Norway, which is in Scandinavia, obviously, with a song about TV.
The sun always shines on TV.
That was Aha with The Sun Always Shines on TV, queuing up tonight's final segment, which is Midori House's regular wrap-up of things cultural. As that song rather gives away, we are discussing television, and joining me here in the studio is Alice Vincent from The Telegraph. Alice, welcome to the show. First of all, the much-hyped Orange is the New Black, now into its second series. Is it much and deservedly hyped, or just much hyped?
When I first saw the first series, much hyped, but second one, it's really come through. It's brought so much drama. It's genuinely bingeable. It's brilliant.
Bingeable's a lovely word. It is interesting. It's a thing I've noticed shifting. There's a weird, contrast between the music business, which has become increasingly divorced from its physical product, whereas television, which never used to have a physical product, is now being made to be bought on box sets.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Orange is the New Black is Netflix's creation. So really, this series is made for a Netflix subscription package. But yeah, I mean,
therefore invalidating my hastily confected theory.
I'm sure at some point it will be available on DVD, but you've got to pay to watch it, certainly.
Okay, well, we have a clip of Orange is the New Black. It goes like this.
I am prepared to behave like a model inmate, and I feel I no longer pose a threat.
Like, what have you done with the place?
Sadly, it's starting to feel like home in here.
3, 2, 1, go!
This is not how I imagined prison to be at all.
A woman I knew a long time ago came back in yesterday.
And, who are you?
MV. A clip there from Orange is the New Black. It's far from the first ever prison drama, because prison's obviously a great setting for drama. It's like police procedurals and hospitals. They're things that television cannot leave alone. Does it remind you of any antecedents? I'm guessing Prisoner Cell Block H wasn't a huge influence.
No, not really. The interesting thing about it is, firstly, it's a women's prison, so its precedent's kind of bag girls. And also, it's a very domestic, it's a light security prison. So they have lots of sort of fun luxuries like a beauty salon and nice parties and things like that. So that allows a lot of levity to come into the situation.
So, I mean, that was a real strength. I remember thinking of something like The Wire, or to a slightly sillier extent, Justified, that even within the framework of alleged drama, there were still some extremely funny moments.
Yes, and it is very funny. It's very dark humour, though. Often the jokes are about their incarceration, which isn't the funniest thing in the world.
But it's not remorselessly grim.
No, not at all.
Okay, well, that's Orange is the New Black, second series underway. You also want to talk about a documentary which we did play a clip of earlier, and which, dag nabbit, we're going to play again, because I think this is one of those things where we need to have the clip first, and then we can explain ourselves.
I didn't talk to Peter the way I talked to you. I spoke in single words, usually, and made inflection, something that he could follow. That they were very good at. The enunciation was not good. But if I said 1, 2, 3, I wouldn't get 1, 2, 3, but I could get
1, 2, 3.
In your own time, Alice, explain to us what on earth was going on there.
Well, that was a lady in the 1960s trying to teach a dolphin to speak English.
Okay, that sounds like the sort of thing that people did in the 60s. This was the subject of a documentary called, prosaically enough, The Girl Who Talked to Dolphins. Did they have any luck in teaching dolphins to speak English?
Not really. I mean, they...
amazing.
Yeah. In hindsight, it seems bizarre. They were funded by NASA. They thought it would be a way to speak to aliens. There was a lot of LSD floating around. But really, the dolphins could just mimic English words badly rather than understand them.
NASA had clearly not considered the possibility that the aliens would not be dolphins.
Clearly not. It was a space race, you know.
Are there any enduring lessons from it about today's that we can look upon now, or is it other than the sort of futility of teaching dolphins to speak English, or is it just a purely a period piece? This film is sort of reflection on people doing weird things under the influence of other weird things in the 60s.
I think the nicest thing about it, if you can take a positive, is that the braveness of the experiment before the drugs and the nasty stuff happened. it was really bold, and John Lilly, who's the man behind it all, was, you know, lauded as some kind of genius. It did also lead to other adventures in animal science, which is slightly more sensible. Also animal cruelty as well. There's lots to be learned from there.
I never quite figured out what the big deal is with dolphins and why people want to just pester them and interact with them.
They've got big brains.
Clearly they're not that smart. I mean, you know, I'm saying you don't often see dolphins on the shortlist for the Booker Prize.
No, not yet.
Well, indeed, they may be playing the long game. We should move along finally to Utopia, not the hectoring John Pilger documentary of the same name, but the recently, the Channel 4 thriller, which had its first series last year. It is often said, especially recently, as we've seen more and more genuinely great landmark television from America, Orange is the New Black being just the latest installment, that British television lags behind it in terms of quality and, I guess, as a consequence of lagging behind in terms of resources. Did Utopia stand comparison with those big American ones?
Absolutely, and in a very British way as well. It was very quirky. It was, again, darkly funny, but they adopted very cinematic ways of filming it. There were these brilliant filters, there was a lot of colour. Yeah, it was definitely up there with the big...
OK, well, we have a clip of Utopia, which is allegedly returning in August.
It's a comic.
It's a graphic novel. It's called The Utopia Experiments. It's about a scientist who makes a deal with the devil.
It's like opening a door into another world.
It's opening a door to reality.
Who is Jessica Hyde?
Who are you? And what's going on?
Do you want to see my nuclear fallout shelter?
You should make it your mission.
But how well?
All of us have a mission in life. This is yours.
Who?
What?
Why?
Are you trying to wind me up?
You have no idea how powerful they are.
Things are going to get mad.
People are dying.
You okay? Would you like some tea?
I don't drink tea. Caffeine was invented by the CIA.
Utopia returning in August. For those of us who haven't seen it, Alison, just briefly, if you would, as the clock is against it, what is it a bit like? Like, if you've seen X, you might enjoy...
It's a bit Coen Brothers-esque, I'd say. Conspiracy theory. The real thing is it's unlike anything else. If you like dark humor, you like conspiracy, watch it.
Alice, thank you. Alice Vincent from The Telegraph there with our regular TV review. And that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, George Brock and Daniela Peled. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexandra Stenbock-Firmer, and our studio manager was Bill Luthi. Next up after the headlines is The Entrepreneurs, hosted by our producer Daniel. Then at 2200, I'm back with Emma Nelson for The Monocle Daily. I'll also be back with this show at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye, and also it was Australia 2, Netherlands 3. Never mind. Thank you for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.